Welcome to Living with Dying, a podcast where we're going to talk about the unspeakable, everything to do with death and dying, and how to live with it. We're all on the same journey towards the end, but we just never talk about it. We don't like to think of our own life ending, and we certainly don't like to contemplate losing our nearest and dearest. So we all join in this huge conspiracy, pretending it won't happen to us. And then, when it does, we're often ill-prepared. So we're saying, let's talk about death. Let's open up the subject, and by listening to other people's stories, glean some advice and tips on how best to approach death, how to deal with loss, and how to rebuild a life after. I'm Dilys Morgan, and I lost my husband Michael Barrett last year. I'm recording this episode in the Thames Hospice, a wonderful place where they looked after Michael in the last week of his life. And what better place to start than somewhere where everyone is very familiar with death? Simon Smith, the chief counsellor at the hospice, is here to help me tell my story and to tease out the many unexpected feelings I had when first faced with loss. So I married Michael Barrett, who people may remember from Nationwide and Panorama and other BBC programmes like Songs of Praise and Gardener's Question Time. When I joined the programme Nationwide, I came in as the new young presenter, and he was the long-standing expert. So he was asked to take me under his wing, which he did very successfully, really. We didn't fall for each other immediately. We worked alongside each other for quite a while and then gradually fell for each other and ended up leaving the programme and getting married. So we'd been together for 47, 48 years. And I suppose latterly, since both of us stopped working, we had literally been in each other's pockets day and night, 24 hours a day, for some 12, 13, 14, 15 years. So when he died, and I'll come on to that in a minute, because it wasn't exactly sudden death and it wasn't exactly expected, but it was a huge shock because it felt like half of me had been taken away. People talk about their other halves, don't they? And I now know exactly what they mean, because it literally feels like you've been cut in half. And everything you lived for, really, has suddenly been kind of pulled from underneath you. So it was difficult. And if I tell you a bit about the circumstances, I mean, I am 19 years younger than he was, so I suppose I always expected that he would go first. We didn't talk about it a lot. He would always turn it into a joke if I tried to talk about it. He would often say, well, my father buried two wives and I'm expecting to do the same. So we never got very far because it became a laugh, a joke. Although we had written down the wishes that we both wanted for a service or a funeral or an ending, I made him do that by saying that I was going to do it and I thought we should both do it, and we swapped our ideas. So that was quite good. But we didn't really talk about what my life or his life would be afterwards. And I regret that. But people don't find it easy to talk about death, do they?
No, they don't. They really don't. And that was something that you experienced there. You couldn't quite go any further in that conversation.
I don't know whether he was shutting it down deliberately. Occasionally it was touched on, and I know that he was worried about how I would live. I know because we talked about the house and we talked about finances a little bit, but that was some time ago, actually. That was more like 6 or 7 or 8 years ago. But I do wish we'd had the kind of conversation where you tell each other that you've had a very good life together. And I may get a bit emotional at points here, but I think that's okay, isn't it? Because that is the point.
Absolutely. And it is very often the case that couples or family members, depending on, you know, the situation, don't find the words, the vocabulary to talk about these things when it's possible to do so. And it's a hard subject, I think, for many, many people.
We leave it too late, don't we? I do remember that when he was in the hospital, I think it wasn't when he was here, because you looked after him very well here at the end of his life, but just before that he'd been in hospital, and he was very in and out of consciousness. He was very often delirious, in fact. And I wrote to my one of my daughters-in-law, Michael keeps saying goodbye and telling me that he wants me to have a good life. But I don't think he's, I think he's delirious. I think he's saying it in his delirium. And I'll never really know now whether he knew what he was saying or not. But even that didn't become a conversation because he was so often away with the fairies that it was hard to take it seriously, really. So, but I, as I say, I wish we'd had that conversation previously and just acknowledged what a good life we had had together and thanked each other for it, really.
Yes. Like you say, it is difficult quite to know when someone is experiencing some delirium, but even with that, there can be moments of lucidity, but like you say, we may never quite know, but I'm sure in his heart of hearts he would have wanted those very things for you to have, you know, a good life afterwards.
You do tell us, or people like you, experts do tell us, that even people when they're unconscious can take things in, don't you? So I remember being told to talk to him. And gosh, I talked nonstop. And I talked a lot about the holidays that we'd had and the happy times we'd had. So hopefully he was able to take that in.
Yes, that's good. You say that the death wasn't exactly sudden and wasn't exactly expected. What do you mean by that? Could you say a little bit more?
Well, I suppose being 19 years younger than him, I had always expected to outlive him. But also, he was 94, but he was a very young 94, and people used to take him for 80, being in his mid-80s, really, rather than in his 90s. So I think we all expected he would go on, and he was very determined and very positive and very appreciative of life. So I think everybody, family and friends, all thought he would survive longer than most. And he was quite well up until the May of the year. He died in July. And up until May, he was really not fit exactly, but we went on holiday. We drove halfway through France and he could cope with that fine. And we had a nice time. He enjoyed the food. He enjoyed going to the beach and things. So he was pretty normal, I suppose. I suppose in a way, maybe I turned a blind eye to the fact that he had been gradually declining. I think possibly I did. And very sadly, he lost two of his children. He had six children from a previous marriage, and he lost two of them in the last 4 years of his life. Daughter Rachel, first of all, from cancer, and then his son, his eldest son, Mark, from cancer also. And I do think those losses aged him.
Right.
I mean, I think that's
inevitable,
isn't it? Really?
Yes, yes,
it's a big thing to cope
with.
That's
really hard, yes.
So I think he kind of gradually declined, deteriorated probably from then on. So that's why it wasn't really expected. Although I'd seen this gradual decline, I had thought he would go on. And then when he went into hospital, I honestly thought he'd come out. I thought he'd gone into hospital for them to fix him and he'd be back home before long. But it seemed as it went on that they kept finding more and more things wrong with him. And in the end, it became clear that they weren't going to be able to get him right, and that's when we took the decision to bring him here to the hospice where you looked after him so well and he spent the last week of his life.
Right. And that must have been very, very difficult, thinking that he was going to recover to some extent from the hospital admission, and then finding that things were very, very different for you coming to a hospice. We know that hospices don't only offer end-of-life care, they also offer pain relief and symptom management to help people get back home. But it was a different situation for Michael, wasn't it?
It was, and maybe I didn't fully understand all that. And, of course, everybody always says, don't they, that you're left with regrets afterwards and things you wish you'd done and haven't done. But I keep looking back and thinking, how did I handle it? Did I do the right thing? But I suppose it was really down to me and the family to decide that he probably needed to come here. And I think it was the right decision, looking back. It was hard. Yes, it feels like the right decision. But you do always say to yourself, well, what if I'd got more doctors involved? What if I'd found some different treatment? What if I'd investigated this, that and the other? But you can't keep doing that for the rest of your life, can you? Or I decided I couldn't keep looking backwards. I had to start looking forwards, really.
But at the hospice, that was when, you know, you finally experienced the reality of Michael dying, and that must have been very, very hard for you, that particular moment, that final moment.
I was staying here. That's what's lovely about this place. You have wonderful rooms and lovely facilities, and the whole family could come often and did, but I stayed 24 hours a day, and you offered me a bed, but I chose to lie in the chair beside his bed so that I was constantly next to him. And it just happened that on the night he died, I'd got up to go to the bathroom, came back and realised his breathing was very shallow. So I decided not to go back to sleep, obviously, and I sat with him and held his hand, and I just leaned over to kiss his cheek, and he took his last breath. And it was lovely in many respects, I suppose. It was a very peaceful way to go. Hmm. But yeah, it was hard.
It was hard, mm-hmm. Yeah. I can see you just there, you know, struggling just to recall that moment, you know.
I'm sure every death is hard. Mm-hmm. But I do tend to look back on it as being a good experience, because he was so peaceful. He wasn't struggling. He wasn't in any pain. And we knew it was time for him to go, I suppose. So, yeah, I treasure that moment. And the fact that I was on my own with him, and I could then stay with him, which I did for about 20 minutes before I went and told anybody.
Right.
Then my daughter came to pick me up. We had a big hug and went home.
And then I guess it's about sharing that news. So what happened next for you there?
Yes, Jess had been staying in our house, so she was handy, so she picked me up. It was 3:52 in the morning, so it was a difficult time to know how to tell people. But, of course, as is the modern way, I used WhatsApp to tell the family. For people who don't know, the hospice here is situated in the most beautiful grounds on the edge of Bray Lake. And after about 20 minutes, I walked out of the room to go outside to get a bit of fresh air. And there was the most wonderful sunrise over the lake. So I took a photo of it and basically let the family know via WhatsApp with the photo. And one of my young grandsons sent a message back, which was so sweet. He said, "Grandpa's putting on a good show."
Oh, that's lovely.
That was very moving. So then Jess took me home, and we arranged for all the rest of the family to come to our house. This was a Sunday. Michael's timing was always good, and it was very helpful that it was a Sunday because everybody was at home. So one of my son-in-laws brought the grandchildren up from Margate. My two sons came with their wives from London, and the children were occupied elsewhere while we sat round and talked about what we were going to do in terms of giving Michael a send-off. And it was fairly easy because he was a man of simple taste. He didn't have very many requirements. He had chosen some poems. He'd chosen a hymn. He didn't specify where he wanted this to be. But we very quickly got together what we called a service of thanksgiving, because we decided on a direct cremation. I don't think any of us liked most crematorium, and I don't think any of us liked the idea of having to stand around a box with Michael in it. So we settled on a direct cremation.
Yes.
And then we had this lovely Thanksgiving service, and people say, don't they, that planning the funeral at that stage, you're probably a bit numb with shock. In my case, it felt very therapeutic because I had all the family around me.
Yes.
And everybody was terribly helpful. They all adopted different roles. They went off in different directions to try and find the right places. It felt good for those 10 days, really, while we were constantly in touch with all the planning. And then the service itself went off very well. I think Michael would have been very pleased with how it happened. And then, as it happened, we had booked a family holiday for all of us in France, and that was going to be a fortnight's holiday for 14 of us. And again, that was a big decision. What did we do about that?
So that would have been with Michael being
yes,
there.
Yes,
we booked
a house big enough for everybody.
Yes.
We decided to go ahead with it because I suppose we were all thinking that it was a nice thing to do and we would all be together. So
yes.
Again, the therapy would continue, if you like, or the therapeutic feeling would continue. In actual fact, and I don't think they'll mind me talking about this, in actual fact, it was quite a turbulent time. I think people's tensions bubbled to the surface and we had quite a lot of squabbles amongst us. But that meant we had quite a lot of tears and hugs as well. So in many ways, it was still good to be together. We were able to toast him and talk about things that he liked. And, oh, wouldn't Dad have loved this? And wouldn't Mike have enjoyed that? But I think everybody was on a bit of a short fuse. And I guess that's almost inevitable, isn't it?
Well, so soon after Michael had died, and everyone's reacting different ways. That's one of the things about grief, which I'm sure we'll be exploring, that you'll be exploring in this podcast series, that people do react differently. And even in the closest, strongest of families, that, you know, everyone is experiencing that loss in a different way that's unique to that individual person.
I certainly felt I lost some patience.
Right.
I became quite irritable quite quickly. I don't know whether that's normal. There probably isn't a normal, is there, at all? And people talk about the different stages of grief, don't they? I don't know what you think about those, but I guess anger was surfacing, really. We were probably all angry in different ways and didn't quite know where to put the anger.
So you've had the family holiday, and then that comes to its conclusion, and you've then got to get back home, and coming back to an empty home. So tell me about how that was for you.
Well, I drove through France on my own, got a ferry on my own. All of the things that I would normally have done with him, that was hard, because we used to do a lot of driving through France together. We used to get the ferries together. But I did it, and then I drove home to an empty house. And that was the first time, I suppose, I opened the front door and thought, right, this is it, really. This is the beginning of the rest of my life. And I've got to work out what to do with it. I didn't think that immediately, I don't think. I found all the usual things difficult, like his chair, his cup, you know, things like that, when I first saw them. It didn't feel like the home that it used to be, I suppose. I think probably the worst things, though, were waking up every morning feeling everything was pointless. I couldn't see the point to the day. I couldn't see the point of getting up. I didn't know what I was here for. That also then led to feelings of selfishness. I used to think, I'm not accustomed to this. For years I've looked after other people. I'm not used to the idea of every day being there for me to please myself. It felt very odd and strange and uncomfortable. And I've talked about this with a lot of other people who've been recently bereaved, and widows in particular, and they say the same thing. They feel pointless, everything's pointless, and they feel very selfish. And it takes a bit of time to get used to those feelings, because they are there every morning, really. I also felt kind of helpless and hopeless. You know, you see an empty future lying ahead of you, and you don't quite know what to do about it. People used to say to me, how are you? And I used to say, well, I don't know. And I don't know how I'm supposed to be at the moment. I felt lost, I suppose, it's a good word to describe it. And the grief comes in waves, it seems, so that you're poddling along, not sort of thinking about very much, and then suddenly you hear something on the radio, maybe, or you see a mug that Mike always used to use, and suddenly the grief wells up and you feel overwhelmed by it. I don't think I dealt with it terribly well. I think I probably tried to take on too much and do too much. I sort of flailed around trying to find things to occupy my time. Like, I volunteered at a new food bank, and I took the opportunity to go into London quite often and go and see the sites that I hadn't seen since before COVID, really, and do things like that. I also had quite a lot of grandchildren sitting to do, which helped fill the time. But looking back on it, I think I was trying to do too much. I was too ambitious, and I wasn't taking the time I really needed to be alone and to grieve. And then I got to the stage where I realised that. And I realised I needed to build in much more time alone at home, because that's where I felt closest to him. Even though it was sad, I felt closest to Mike. So I wanted to do more of that. And I described it as wallowing. I think I did wallow in my grief. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. That was me taking the time I needed to really explore my feelings and go with them really. When you're out and about with other people, you can't. You put on a cheerful front and you get by. But no, I felt I needed that, and I felt that I was on a go slow, really. My brain sort of slowed down. But of course, that's the time when you have to do all the admin. And I think that's really hard, because you don't feel up to it, really, but you have to do it. So my brain would fill full up with stuff, and I would get forgetful and do silly things. I double booked an awful lot of occasions, and I used to have to untangle them then, which was annoying. But I realised that was probably, you know, because I wasn't thinking straight. And I used to do silly things like put things in the fridge that shouldn't have been in the fridge, and things in the larder that should have been in the fridge, and mislaid things. I've lost a whole set of keys that have never come back, never found them. Yeah, that's a really difficult time, I think. And it seems hard that's the point where you have to be sending lots of letters off to places, dealing with probate, dealing with all the banks and all the sort of official bodies. Mm. I mean, I did. I managed to get through it. And then felt quite satisfied, actually, when it was done, when I'd achieved that.
I was going to ask, it can be a really difficult time for many people in the early stages of grief to have to, as you say, do the admin and get those things through when they're feeling such, you know, a sense of loss and so disoriented themselves. But was there an element where actually applying yourself to some of those tasks at least gave you something of a purpose, a function, a needing to do things in a particular day?
Yeah, I think it did. I think it helps you focus on something, doesn't it? And as I talked earlier on about everything feeling pointless, at least there then was a point.
Yes.
I had something I had to get done. And I handled probate myself because I had done it before for my mother, and I felt, why shouldn't I do it again? And I think that was probably therapeutic in its way, because it meant I felt close to Mike all the time going through his things. But talking of going through his things, I wasn't at all good at going through his physical things. His clothes occupied the only big wardrobe in our bedroom, and I really wanted the wardrobe for myself, but I couldn't bear to get rid of his clothes. So I left them there for months and months and months. I used to open the doors and look at them and then shut the doors again, because they were so personal to him. All the things that, you know, he wore every day, really, I still wanted to touch them and know they were there. And I still haven't got rid of them. And we're now 15 months on. I've moved them out of the wardrobe. I put them somewhere else. But I haven't got rid of them. And I think people do that in different ways and on different timescales too, don't they?
I think people listening in will, you know exactly what you're feeling, the dealing with those physical things around the house, and probably the photos too, you know, around your home, and certainly going through clothes. I think it has to be done at a time when the person feels ready, and those times are very different for each person, I think.
I think the worst thing about that is that you are throwing them out. So you're kind of throwing a part of him away. That's what it feels like. Mm. I'm not sure that I'll ever be able to do it, actually. I got rid of all the rubbishy socks and things like that, obviously. But the nice things, I don't know whether I'll ever get to that stage. But it won't matter if I don't. They'll just be left to my children to sort out later, won't it? And I'm sure you're right. I think we need to do it at our own pace.
Those feelings that you mentioned earlier in this podcast of feeling lost and feeling like a half of you was missing, and the kind of feeling pointless, and how dark did it get for you on some days?
The worst day for me was January the 1st, New Year's Day. People talk about birthdays and anniversaries being hard. I didn't find that too much, but that's probably because we always gave birthdays and anniversaries a fairly low profile. Mike usually forgot all the anniversaries and the birthdays, so I got used to that. New Year's Day, I just looked at my diary and there was nothing in it. It was literally an empty year ahead. And it was a horrible day. It was midwinter, obviously, and bleak and dark, and I think it was wet. And I felt very depressed that day. Mm. I had I didn't have any plans at all. His birthday was coming up. His birthday was January the 3rd, and people worried about that on my behalf. How would I be on his birthday? But it was New Year's Day that was by far the worst. And I was dreading the winter anyway, because my mood is often affected by the weather. If the sun's out, I can feel a lot better. And so in the October of the year he died, I was dreading the clocks going back. And I still am this year, actually, because that idea of sort of drawing the curtains at 4 o'clock and knowing that's the end of your day and that you're not likely to go out or see anybody after that, that feels quite challenging.
Yes, yes.
Unless you make plans. And that, of course, is what I've learned to do. I've learned to fill my year and fill my days and find things to do that I can enjoy. I've had to do that because I've got no one else to do it for me.
And in those dark moments where things seemed bleak and you felt depressed and it felt winter all around in many ways, within you and around you, were there people or things that you found helpful in those moments that helped you get through, or were there things that you drew on within yourself in those moments?
I think both, really. I mean, it was always helpful talking to my adult children, and I would do that if I was low. I had certain friends who would come and listen to me in a very helpful way. Other people I found not quite so helpful. I think it's really hard for everyone to know how to deal with people who've been bereaved. Nobody actually asked me what I would like in the way of help, and I think perhaps that's something that maybe we could all learn to do, is to say to people, what is it would you like in the way of support? And I got a lot of support, and still do, from my friends who are also widowed. They're all widows. I don't know anyone who's a widower. But we feel free to talk to each other and get emotional while we talk to each other, which is lovely. And I think everybody needs that, probably. So I can do that with the family, obviously. And I can do it with my friends who are widows. And we give each other a lot of succour and support. And that's ongoing. And I spent a lot of time walking. And walking and talking is always good, isn't it? And helpful.
Yes.
The other thing I did, which not everybody would want to do, I suppose, is I wrote to Mike. I started when we were in France, actually, just wrote him little letters saying what was going on for me and how much I was missing him and what I was missing about him. And that was, in a way, I suppose, my own kind of therapy. I was writing it down. I didn't accept your offer that the hospice has this wonderful offer of counselling for anyone who's been bereaved, but I chose not to accept that. And I wrote to him instead.
And did you find that helped to kind of express what was going on inside you, so that it didn't become stuck inside you, as it were, but you were giving voice to those inward feelings and sadnesses? Is that what it was for you, or something else?
No, I suppose that's right. It was, but it was also a way of being in touch with him.
Yes.
And I would write silly things, like I would almost ask him questions while I was writing the letters to him, like, why aren't you here to help me through this, that kind of thing. But it was certainly helpful, and I've still got them and I still read them, and it's very interesting watching how I got through, really, and how the days did get lighter and I had fewer moments of welling up at the thought of him, and gradually realised that I was going to have to bite the bullet and sort out my own life.
And I've known many people who have journaled or diaried, you know, their feelings and their thoughts, and it does sometimes give people an opportunity to look back and just to measure and chart the progress that has been made, when perhaps they think nothing's happening, you know, that they're stuck, but actually a lot has happened as people find their way through grief.
Yes. That's interesting. So you mean they're not necessarily noticing the progress they're making until they're faced with it?
Absolutely.
In writing.
Yes.
It is difficult because it's incremental progress, isn't it? I was thinking to myself just this week, when the sun was out and it was a lovely day, I was thinking, I'm getting quite a lot of moments of contentment now. The sadness is still there, but it's got peaks and troughs, I suppose, and I'm getting quite a lot of contentment. What it'll be like when the clocks go back there and it's all dull and grey, I think.
Yes. And some people, I think, find it helpful when other people notice things that they may not have noticed, you know, about their own progress and development through grief. And sometimes other people can observe these things, and it's important that they tell the person that they're doing okay. I think some people find it hard to laugh again after a death, and they feel almost guilty for and that can take some learning and some experiencing, and you know, giving yourself permission to enjoy life, to feel contentment in moments, and those kind of qualities.
Yeah, I think there's quite a lot of giving yourself permission involved. Yes. You have to give yourself permission to be sad and to be low and to be emotional.
Mm.
But then you're right, yes, you have to give yourself permission to be happy or content or enjoy moments. And I have had some really lovely, enjoyable moments in recent months. I still miss him. I miss him every day. This last weekend, I had four friends for supper, so there were five of us, and I went to a lot of trouble to get another chair so that there'd be one for each of us. And it wasn't until everybody was sitting down that I realised I'd got six chairs, and obviously completely forgetting that I'm no longer part of a couple. And I think that's what's hard. That's what's hard to take on board. I miss his smile. I miss his chuckles. He often used to chuckle at me at things that I did. I never really knew why, but I used to enjoy his chuckles. I used to enjoy his hugs. I miss those. We shared things too, which I really miss him for now, like little things that happen every day, but also the bigger things like family stuff. Or we both had a passion for news and current affairs, so basically every day there was lots to talk about what was going on in the world. I miss reading books and talking about them afterwards with him. I miss travelling with him. And I find myself doing funny things sometimes, like I will sit at a weekend with the football on. Now, I never used to want to watch football or enjoy football, but Mike would always have it on at a weekend, and I'd often be in the same room reading the newspapers. And so I sometimes strangely find myself doing that, putting it on. And I suppose it's because it reminds me of him, it reminds me of weekends with him. It's familiar, and it's comforting to hear that noise going on in the corner. But Simon, tell me more about how you think people can support somebody who's just been bereaved. What's the best kind of support they can offer?
I think the first thing to say is that, you know, it's important to acknowledge that every single person is unique and has a unique story, and that everyone's bereavement story is unique. Any relationship between two people takes its shape around, you know, the qualities, the characteristics of those two individuals. So it's not surprising that bereavement should take on something that is unique. And it's important to acknowledge that, I think. And so it can be a very dangerous thing when two people are talking for someone to be saying, I'm struggling with this or that, and the other person saying, oh, I know exactly how you feel, this happened to... We can't quite connect those two things. No two stories are exactly the same, and we need to leave people the space to be able to, you know, voice what they're going through as an individual. And when a loved one dies, as you've been saying, dear Liz, it can be really painful and very stressful and complicated. We can feel overwhelmed, confused by our own emotions, what's going on. Sometimes we think we're going a bit crazy, but actually, usually these are the normal, if you like, expressions of grief and sadness and sorrow. So coming to terms with the death of a loved one, however that life had ended, may take a long time, and it can be difficult and a long and winding road at times. I think we see expressions of shock, even when the death was expected. And as you've indicated, there'll be lots and lots of practical things that need attention, and it can be hard to think straight at such times. And sometimes after a funeral can be the loneliest time, because everyone has come together, and then suddenly people resume their usual routines, and the person who is bereaved is very alone. We know that grief can affect people in all kinds of different ways. This can be disbelief, anger, guilt, numbness, loneliness, sobbing, relief, regret, a loss of appetite, lack of sleep, an inability to concentrate. We may find ourselves losing concentration, losing confidence in ourselves, even if we were very, very capable and used to do all kinds of things. Suddenly we feel we can't do the most basic thing. And some people imagine that they can see or hear the person who has died, and that's a very common thing. And as you've described, emotions can be triggered by familiar places and particular dates or special anniversaries or the 1st of January for you. But sometimes, you know, grief can catch us unawares at the smallest of things, the thing we wouldn't have associated, but it can just happen like that. And so I think the bereavement support that we offer here at the hospice, and that many hospices and other bereavement agencies offer, wants to acknowledge the uniqueness of each grief, of each person. But we are all human at the end of the day. And so I think that there are aspects of grief and there are patterns of grief that are common to us all. And a trusted friend can be helpful. Sometimes a trained bereavement counsellor can be very, very helpful too, because they have the experience and the expertise to give each person the space to say exactly what they want to say. And sometimes even in the closest of families, we find ourselves not being quite sure that we can say that, because we know that it might upset another person or it could have a bearing on that other person in the family. But with a counsellor, we can say exactly what we want to say and know that that is a safe, private space. And counsellors can recognise those kind of threads and those trends and patterns of grief and allow that person to give full expression to their feelings and to find a way through. And that's what we find here in the individual support we provide, and also in the group support that we facilitate here as well at the hospice.
I think a key thing is that somebody who has been bereaved doesn't want to be a burden.
Yes.
So what you've just described is the way you can let out all your feelings in a safe space, but you're not being a burden to the counsellor, because that's what they're expecting from you.
Absolutely.
I'm very conscious of that, that you don't want to be the kind of friend who's always miserable on the other end of the phone. You don't want to see people and bring them down with your own misery. So you do have to be careful who you talk to, and that is why I suppose, as I said earlier, I find other widows are great, because we all know where we're coming from.
Yes, that's absolutely right, and I think counsellors provide that space to individuals who are bereaved, with the intention that that person, having described their feelings and expressed their feelings and their thoughts and their state of mind and what they're finding difficult. And the intention is that that person will be enabled to then live without counselling and to go back to relationships and families and work and other activities, feeling more resilient and more at ease with themselves.
Thank you so much, Simon. We'll be having more chats in future episodes about everything to do with death and dying, such as how to prepare for it, what it's really like when someone dies, how to talk about it, what kind of plans to make, how different cultures and faiths approach dying and bereavement, lots more around grief and loss, how to support others in their sadness, and my personal hobby horse, how to rebuild a life, a good life, after the loss of someone special. If you'd like to join us to talk about the death of someone near to you, if this episode has resonated with you and you have a story to share, or if you've been affected by some of the issues raised, please do get in touch at hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.